Parenthood being cut. And Ola, we only have 10 seconds.
Planned Parenthood is directly correlated with Medicaid, and women of color who receive services from Planned Parenthood will be affected. We need to keep the ACA alive and the Medicaid expansion so women and women of color particularly can still get access to Planned Parenthood services, cancer screenings, and mammograms.
We're going to have to leave it there. On Ola's Facebook page, it says, no one should have to fight this hard for what should be treated as a human right. Ola Ojuwumi, Kaylin Heffernan, Stephanie Woodward, thanks so much for joining us. Our website is democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
You are listening to KBOO FM. The time is 4:59.
Sponsor of the Onion Music Fest on July 28th and 29th at Sunnyside Outdoor Events. The second Onion Music Fest is a celebration of personal expression and community with 2 days and nights of music and camping featuring Onion the Man, La Rivera, The Odd Tet, Meat Creature, and many more. Again, that's the Onion Music Fest on July 28th and 29th at Sunnyside Outdoor Events, 30303 Northeast 10th Street in Washougal, Washington. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
Tune in Thursdays from 6 to 7 p.m. to hear Rose City Native Radio with your host, Jackie Malmstrom. Rose City Native Radio is a new public affairs program bringing you local and national Native issues and Native contemporary music. You can find more information about the show online at kboo.fm or find us on Facebook at Rose City Native Radio.
This program is made possible by KBOO members and support from the Clinton Street Theater, featuring independent and revival films, the Rocky Horror Picture Show every Saturday at midnight, as well as KBOO night every second Thursday. Clinton Street Theater is located at the corner of Southeast 26th and Clinton in Portland. Schedule in an info at 503-238-5588 or cstpdx.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a motion to intervene has been filed on behalf of the Siletz River ecosystem by a Lincoln County citizen.
We'll hear the latest in Native American news from our friends at Native News.
And we'll also take a look at the public comment period for a police directive 416, which deals with the altered duty assignments given to officers following an officer-involved shooting.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News.
Thursday, July 27th, 2017. I'm Tom.
And I'm Grace Ann Smith. This morning, the Portland Police Bureau held an induction ceremony for 13 new officers and 2 professional staff. The 9 o'clock ceremony was interrupted briefly by protesters. KBOO reporter Sam Bowman spoke with one of them, Mimi Gurman, who has been a regular presence at public meetings and protests during Ted Wheeler's term as mayor and before.
Ceremony that they swore in 13 new police officers and 2 professional staff. Can you just tell me a little bit about what this looked like?
The room wasn't full. I had expected it to be full, and it was in the Portland building. You know, there were families inside taking up seats, but there were a lot of empty seats, which, again, was surprising. There were quite a few cops there, but not as many as I had thought. And all of the new inductees were on the stage. And Chief Marshman, when I walked in, was giving a speech full of lies about what these new officers can look forward to regarding helping victims in our city get their perpetrators caught. And as soon as I walked in the door, I was nervous. I was nervous when I went, because I really did think that the whole room was going to be filled with cops. And I knew that I was about to crash this. So as soon as I got in, he was talking about perpetrators being brought down by cop dogs, and how we have great police dogs as well as officers who help bring down perpetrators in support of the victims. And my thoughts went immediately to last week in San Diego, when the police officers took down a man, a black man who was maybe mentally ill, I don't even know, took him down with a police dog, not with a taser, not with words, not with handcuffs, not with anything, but chose to use a police dog, and they couldn't get the dog off of this man's arms. And the video of that went viral, and I had seen it last week. Then he went from police dogs immediately to a couple that was victimized in a parking lot, and how the police had found the perpetrator of whatever crime supposedly happened. And I'm thinking immediately of Karen Bates, who died in a parking lot over the winter because she couldn't pay her rent and ended up leaving her apartment to live in her car during the freeze that we had, and died in her car, and no one helped her. But here he is talking about some other group of people, you know, getting saved by the police. And that was the tenor and the timbre of his speech. We save people. So as soon as he started talking about this couple, I yelled out, "You murdered Quanis Hayes. You killed Quanis Hayes. You shot him in the head." And somebody in front of me right away turned around to me and said, "This is a special event," meaning I should be quiet because this is a special event. To which I yelled out, "Quanis Hayes led a special life. He was alive and he was killed by the cops." So then I yelled out, "What about Terrell Johnson? You murdered Terrell Johnson. You murdered Terrell Johnson."
And for our listeners, that's the young man who was shot on the Max tracks out in Lentz a couple months ago, yeah.
Right. So at this point, the security team of G4S was in my face, you know, slowly walking me out, you know, pushing me out of the room. And I started to yell out loud to Marshman that he's lying. These are all lies. The police kill, that Black Lives Matter, no money for bullets for live target ammo, which is what, for those who don't know, there is still at the table at City Council, they're waiting to pass the vote to give $4 million more dollars to the police for live ammo for target practice. And my feeling about it, and I've been outspoken about this, as have some other people in the community, that our police, first of all, don't need any more target practice, and that the target practice that they do is on our houseless community, is on the Black community, is on kids in the Black community, and anyone else they feel like targeting at any given moment. So they're good on target practice.
You mentioned the woman who died in the Karen Bates, who died over the winter. That not the only person by far who died on the streets this winter.
No, and there were seven.
Yeah, and you and others have been raising this refrain ever since Ted Wheeler was elected. Have you heard anything substantive from the administration in response to what you've brought up?
No, Ted has lied about all of his responses to the deaths of the houseless, which he never even addressed. He lied about all of the efforts going into taking care of the houseless right after we started to shut down City Council in January over the freeze, over nothing being done during that freeze. He started to lie about the things that he was doing, which in fact he wasn't doing. He opened one floor of one building. That is what he did. And that floor of that one building, which was in the Portland building, he made himself out to be a hero. The reality of that move was only that he got to look like a hero and that the rest of Portland, who were living out on the streets, couldn't get there. They couldn't get to any shelters that were near them because there were no shelters that were near them. So all of his fixes that he talked about doing, he didn't do. They weren't real.
Is there anything you'd like to add about this morning?
We talk about Black Lives Matter, and I want to say that it's not a slogan. Black Lives Matter is a reality, and if you're going to use that and you're going to say that, then you need to show up. You need to find things that are going on and make yourself present in the resistance of things like cops killing black lives, let's say, or cops harassing protesters and arresting protesters because we're protesting, or cops doing sweeps. These things need to be resisted, and resisting from your house does nothing. I say go to city council, see what this city is doing. You can learn a lot about the cops at city council. You can learn a lot about where our money is actually going, and learn what is truly happening here.
Thank you, Mimi Gurman. And for our listeners, City Council is Wednesday mornings at 9 a.m., correct?
That's right. They also have a 2 o'clock.
Thank you very much for speaking with me today, Mimi.
Thank you, Sam. Thank you to KBOO.
For KBOO Evening News in Portland, I'm Sam Bowman.
The Portland Police Bureau is seeking public comment on a new draft of one of its directives. Directive 416 deals with the altered duty assignments given to officers following an officer-involved shooting. The officer involved in the shooting, as well as any affected witnessing officers, will be placed on administrative leave. The directive does not cover the so-called 48-hour rule. The public comment period opened on Monday and closes on August 10th, a slightly longer period than the previous group of draft directives. Those directives dealt with many of the crucial aspects of the city's settlement deal with the U.S. Department of Justice, namely use of force, force reporting, and guidelines for using lethal and so-called less lethal weapons. The Albina Ministerial Alliance Coalition, a network of community police watchdogs and other groups, repeatedly demanded that the review period be lengthened. They also requested a red line version of the draft directives showing where changes had been made. The administrative leave directive, now under review, is the first one to include a red line version. Citizens and community groups can read and give feedback on this directive by going to portlandoregon.gov/police and clicking on directives.
Just a quick warning to the following story. Well, a quick warning to younger viewers or more sensitive listeners. The following story does contain some graphic details and runs for about a minute and 20 seconds. Today in Clark County, Deputy Christopher North is being tried for charges of second-degree custodial sexual assault of a female inmate. The inmate in question was being transferred from Cowlitz County Jail to Clackamas with an overnight stay in the Clark County Jail. The alleged assault took place in a changing room without cameras. The deputy is said to have entered the room with his pants undone on the morning of July 11th and masturbated on her while she changed. The garments that she was wearing have been identified as having semen on them. The deputy said that he had taken the pants with him during his lunch break and ejaculated on them his car before returning the garments to her bag. He denies having any contact with her, but does say they had a conversation about tattoos. The inmate waited until she was transferred to Clackamas Jail to report the assault out of fear of retaliation. North, the accused deputy, has been working for Clark County Department of Corrections since 2015. Sheriff Chuck Atkins says, quote, "I take this extremely serious and I will not allow this type of misconduct to take place in my jail," end quote. North is being held on a $50,000 bond in Clark County Jail for the time being.
U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions is not a man who has endeared himself to many Americans. While serving as the U.S. Attorney for Alabama, he was denied a federal judgeship due to charges of racism. As a senator, he was a staunch supporter of gun rights and opposed Planned Parenthood and abortion rights. He was the first Republican senator to publicly support Donald Trump for president, long before it was certain that Trump would win the nomination. And since becoming Attorney General, he has pushed the Trump agenda by opposing sanctuary cities and legalized marijuana, while reinstituting civil asset forfeiture and a push for maximum penalties for even minor crimes. But within the last week, Sessions has come under relentless attack from the president for his decision to recuse himself from the investigation into the Trump campaign's ties to Russia. The president has complained that if he knew Sessions would have recused himself, he would have never hired him. Senate colleagues, Justice Department officials, and legal experts all agree that recusing himself was absolutely the right thing to do. But by taking that step, Sessions was no longer in a position to provide Trump with the protection and unquestioned loyalty that the president demands. So despite the fact that his was one of the most contentious Senate confirmation hearings, and that he has historically shown a remarkable lack of sympathy for those less fortunate, Sessions himself has somehow managed to become a sympathetic public figure.
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a Diversified Media Enterprises production. I'm Doug Cunningham. Senator Bernie Sanders is blasting what Trump says was a great step forward, the GOP Senate vote to advance repeal of the Affordable Care Act.
What Trump thinks is a great step forward is part of his belief that we should throw 22 million people off of health insurance, raise premiums for older workers, and cut Medicaid by $800 billion. That's not what the American people think is a great step forward.
Speaking on CNN, Sanders says medical studies show that when millions of people lose health insurance, thousands will die.
Study after study, including studies done at the Harvard School of Public Health, show when you throw 23 million people off of health insurance, people who are now receiving cancer treatment, people who have serious heart diseases, people who have diabetes, people who have life-threatening illnesses, what do you think happens? And what study after study shows is that many, many thousands of people will die. Republicans don't like to hear it. They don't want to hear it, then they should not pass legislation that would do exactly that.
If Trump's Republicans were serious about lifting a finger to help working people, they would immediately vote to raise the minimum wage. That's because in the 21 states with a $7.25 an hour minimum wage, an average of 36.8% of the workforce would get raises if the minimum wage were raised. According to the National Employment Law Project, that's 20.7 million workers who would have more money in their pockets. Democrats do want to raise wages. Senator Chuck Schumer and Bernie Sanders have introduced the Raise the Wage Act of 2017 in the U.S. Senate, and 28 Democrats are co-sponsoring it. The Democrats want to raise wages to a minimum of $15 an hour by 2024. Trump's Republicans, though, refuse to raise the minimum wage. On Wednesday, Trump's Labor Department took the first step to take overtime pay eligibility away from millions of workers. An Obama administration overtime rule expanded overtime pay for so-called managerial workers. Before Obama, these workers making more than $23,000 a year could not get overtime pay. The Obama rule expanded that salary threshold up to $47,000. Millions of people earning between $23,000 and $47,000 would get overtime pay under Obama's rule. Trump's Labor Department, though, doesn't want those workers to get overtime pay. The news is brought to you by IMPACT, the Iron Worker Management Progressive Action Cooperative Trust. IMPACT's mission is more jobs for contractors and for Iron Worker members. You can become an Iron Worker in Washtenaw Community College's pre-apprenticeship program. Finish 24 credits at your own pace and become an Iron Worker Local 25 apprentice. Earn while you learn. Apply now at wcnet.edu/iron. That's wcnet.edu/iron. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit workersindependentnews.com.
And now it's Labor History in Two from our friends at the Illinois Labor History Society and the Rick Smith Show.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1918. That was the day miners' president Ginger Goodwin was shot dead in British Columbia. His murder sparked Canada's first general strike in Vancouver the following week. Goodwin had arrived in British Columbia 8 years earlier and found work in the Cumberland Mines on Vancouver Island. He considered working conditions in the mines absolutely appalling and began advocating for safety and organizing miners. He was soon blacklisted after participating in a 2-year coal miner strike for recognition on the island. He moved to Trail, British Columbia, where he emerged as a Socialist Party candidate in the 1916 election. He was also elected president of the International Union of Mine, Mill and Smelter Workers, District 6, the vice president of British Columbia's Federation of Labor, and the head of the local Trades and Labor Council. He openly expressed his opposition to Canada's entry into the war, stating that workers were now employed in killing each other. He was found unfit for military duty after a medical exam. That was until he led a strike for the 8-hour day at Consolidated Mining and Smelting. It was the world's largest lead and zinc smelter and a key munitions producer during the war. His status was quickly changed to make him eligible for conscription. He fled to the Cumberland Hills, where he hid out for months to avoid the draft. And on this day, Goodwin was shot dead by a Dominion Police special constable. He was brought back to Cumberland, where thousands turned out for his funeral in a mile-long procession. The Vancouver labor movement was outraged by Goodwin's murder and called a one-day general strike on August 2nd to protest his killing.
Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, and follow us on the Twitters at Labor History.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report on efforts to legalize cannabis in a county in Nevada from Cannabis Radio News. At 6, it's Rose City Native Radio. Then at 7, it's Hard Knock Radio. News and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight's weather will be a little cooler than it has been, with a low of 57, tomorrow we'll have a high of 85 and a low of 57 with partial clouds. Today in history, in the year 1054, Siward, Earl of Northumbria, invaded Scotland and defeated the Scottish king north of the Firth of Forth. That king's name was Macbeth, and his relatively benign reign later became a dark legend, and a few people have wrote some plays about him. Also in 1974, another ruler's downfall was initiated when the House Judiciary Committee voted to start the impeachment of President Richard Nixon during the Watergate scandal. The quote of the day is from former associate director of the FBI and America's most famous leaker, W. Mark Felt, who said, "Follow the money."
It's 5:21. Time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
In addition to news, which involves reporting on real stuff, there's now fake news, stuff that's completely made up. But wait, the barons of corporate news are also adding to today's tumultuous state of journalism by putting out BS news, stuff they know is untrue but is reported because it advances their owner's political agenda. For example, The Washington Post, owned by Amazon CEO Jeff Bezos, who's a laissez-faireland promoter of privatizing government functions, keeps publishing a load of BS to denigrate our post offices. In an alarmist editorial, the paper declared, "The U.S. Postal Service continues to hemorrhage red ink." Embracing Bezos' privatization ideology, the editors grumped that postal unions have made our mail service outmoded and insolvent, running up, quote, "a net loss of $5.6 billion last year." That is pure bovine excrement, and the editors know it. In fact, thanks to innovative and efficient postal workers, the mail agency racked up a $610 million operating profit last year and a $1.2 billion profit the year before. The $5 billion in red ink that the paper's propagandists pointed to is nothing but a bookkeeping hoax created by Congress to make people believe our post office is a hopeless money loser that must be privatized. In 2006, Congress manufactured an artificial loss for the Postal Service by decreeing that it pre-fund the health care costs of future retirees 75 years in advance. That includes retirees who are not even born yet. No other agency and no corporation, including Amazon, could survive if Congress added a $5 billion a year fictitious loss to their books. This is Jim Hightower saying, yet, in a shameful piece of BS journalism, the Washington Post intentionally ignored the true story.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
As we reported yesterday, the Siletz River ecosystem has intervened in a lawsuit against Lincoln County on Oregon's coast. The lawsuit was brought by Rex Capri of Newport and Wakefield Farms of Eddyville, who dispute the legality of a ballot measure banning aerial pesticide spraying in the county. The measure passed after a prolonged vote count in May. Lincoln County citizen Carol Von Strum filed the motion to intervene on behalf of the Siletz River ecosystem, acting as a human part of that ecosystem. In a press release, she said, quote, "Like the Lorax, I speak for the rights of the waters and forest and wildlife to challenge human violations of natural law," end quote. If this legal strategy sounds unfamiliar, it is. This is only the third time an ecosystem has intervened in a lawsuit in the United States, though it has been done in other countries as well. The main group supporting the aerial spray ban measure, Lincoln County Community Rights, also intervened in the lawsuit earlier this month. KBOO reporter Sam Bowman spoke with one of the group's founders, Maria Sos, to find out more about this legal strategy and the lawsuit at hand.
Thank you so much for speaking with me today, Maria. So,
thank you for having me.
Absolutely. What is the overall lawsuit? What is the main complaint?
The overall lawsuit claims that our ordinance goes against a series of Oregon statutes, and we deny that that's the case.
And so...
We were not initially, in the lawsuit. It was the county, but we have asked for permission to intervene in the lawsuit, and we have been granted that.
And this is just to be clear, this is all in county court.
This is all in county court. Yeah, the circuit court.
And so, most recently, Carol Van Strum. She didn't intervene, but she is sort of representing the Siletz River ecosystem.
Well, exactly. She's speaking for the Siletz River ecosystem, and the ecosystem is intervening in the lawsuit also. And, of course, the ecosystem can't speak, so it needs somebody to speak for it, and Carol Van Strum is that person.
And legally speaking, in the context of this intervention, what is defined as the Siletz River ecosystem?
Well, it's the Siletz River. It's a watershed. It's all the creatures that live because that watershed and river exists, both plant and animal. It's the people that live in that watershed also. And the Siletz ecosystem is sort of representative of many other river ecosystems in the county, and all of which have suffered great harm because of aerial pesticide spraying. The Siletz ecosystem being one of the prime examples of that harm. It's been harmed exceedingly.
And,
so that's why we chose the Siletz River ecosystem. It's also the main drinking water source for the city of Toledo, and in times of drought, it also gives drinking water to Newport and to Seal Rock and smaller communities in the county.
And is this move to the intervention of the Siletz River ecosystem, is this legal move based on any particular precedent that you're aware of?
Well, it's the third time in the United States that an ecosystem intervenes in a lawsuit. And in other countries, the rights of nature, which this is part of, this effort, is more advanced than here. The rights of nature are an integral part of the Constitution of Ecuador, for instance. And a river has been granted personhood rights in New Zealand. And there is legal action going on to grant these kinds of rights to nature in Colombia, in Australia, in Nepal, and in India. So I guess this struggle to get, you know, governments to understand that nature has to be protected at a higher standard than it is protected now by so-called environmental laws is progressing. Just it's a little harder to do it here in the United States.
And what do you think makes it harder?
Because nature is seen as property, and property is very important in the laws of the United States. In many cases, it turns out to be more important than people. And people have a hard time, and government has a hard time giving personhood to nature, and it should not be that way, because if corporations can have personhood and they only exist on paper, then nature, which is life-giving and contains all forms of life, and our own lives depend on it, it should be very, very easy to understand how nature needs to be represented in our legal system, not just as property, but as a source of life.
I understand it's only been a few days, but have you heard much reaction from people in Lincoln County about this intervention by the Siletz River ecosystem?
Well, I have not heard anything on from what was our opposition in the campaign, but I've heard from people who I know and who were on our side who didn't know that this was going to happen, and they're very, very happy about it and think that it was time that this should happen.
All right. And just lastly for today, what's next what's coming up next in this lawsuit and I guess for Lincoln County community rights?
Okay, the whole lawsuit is there to decide whether our ordinance is legal or not. Okay, this is what the plaintiffs want to know.
Okay.
Okay, or this is, they're claiming that it is illegal. We're claiming that it is legal. And so the judge is going to have to decide. We have filed the intervention of the ecosystem, but we do not have the order issued by the judge that it is part of the lawsuit yet. And we're still waiting for that, and we don't know exactly when she is going to issue that. But we expect that she will, since none of the parties in the lawsuit objected to us filing for the intervention of the ecosystems, of the Siletz ecosystem.
Who again filed the lawsuit against the measure?
Okay, this is a man named Rex Capri and Wakefield Farms. Rex Capri is from Newport, and Wakefield Farms is from Eddyville.
I've been speaking with Maria Saus with the group Lincoln County Community Rights. Maria, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Okay, thank you so much for having me.
For KBOO Community Radio, I'm Sam Bowman.
And now it's National Native News from our friends at Native Voice One. You can find this and other shows and stories at nvone.org.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Federal regulators say if the Atlantic Coast Pipeline is done right, it would cause less than significant environmental impacts in North Carolina, Virginia, and West Virginia. Developers say the proposed 600-mile underground natural gas pipeline would serve multiple public utilities and assist with growing energy needs. But as North Carolina Public Radio's Rebecca Martinez reports, a scientist is challenging that, saying there are flaws in the pipeline's environmental impact statement. And he says it overlooks another concern, the impact on Native Americans.
This month, the journal Science published a letter from Ryan Emanuel. He's an associate professor of environmental resources at NC State University. He's also a member of the Lumbee Tribe of North Carolina. Emanuel says the pipeline route cuts through an inordinate amount of tribal land. This puts tribes at risk of pollution, land devaluation, and destruction of cultural sites.
Our ancestors are buried all up and down parts of eastern North Carolina. And so these are really sacred places to my people, the Lumbee, and to all the other tribes that are impacted by this project.
Emanuel's letter points out that 13% of the people impacted by the Atlantic Coast Pipeline are Native Americans, but indigenous people only make up 1% of North Carolina's overall population. He says the EPA's generic guidelines allowed this impact to be overlooked. For National Native News, I'm Rebecca Martinez in Chapel Hill.
Canada's High Court has rejected plans for seismic testing in Nunavut, the CBC reports. The Supreme Court ruling is a victory for Inuit people who say the sound wave technology would impact marine life and say they were not adequately consulted by federal regulators, which gave oil companies the green light for testing. In the decision Wednesday morning, justices say the consultation process had little, if any, consideration of treaty rights or impacts to subsistence. The National Chief of the Assembly of First Nations discussed racism against Indigenous people during the opening of the organization's annual meeting Tuesday in Saskatchewan. More from Dan Karpinchuk.
Perry Bellegarde says First Nations people continue to face what he calls alarming acts of hatred and violence. He referred to incidents such as the death of an Indigenous man who was shot by a white farmer in Saskatchewan while he was riding an SUV on the farmer's land. Counter-protests against First Nations who called for the removal of a statue in Halifax. And the recent deaths of Indigenous teens in Thunder Bay, Ontario, where there have been ongoing tensions between local police and Indigenous people. Bellegarde added that every child has a right to a safe and healthy home and to grow up in a society where they are treated with dignity and respect and have the same opportunities as other children. And for that, he said, the violence, the racism, and the discrimination must end.
Our priority, our children, our future. That's why we do what we do every day. To make life better for our children, to create a world where there is a better future, one where our human rights, our inherent rights, our collective rights, and our treaty rights are respected.
Some leaders who attended the meeting called for tougher hate crime legislation, while others want better education as a way to combat racism. But Bellegarde also said that First Nations must do their part to deal with abuse in their communities, and they need to work with other Canadians to solve the many problems they face. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
Legislation was signed into law this week in New York, which expands the jurisdiction of the St. Regis Mohawk Police Department in an area which has long been recognized as belonging to the tribal community. Tribal leaders and police say the permanent expansion will help strengthen public safety. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation.
And by Humboldt State University, we know what it means to be rooted in community. You can get your Master's of Social Work and amplify your voice without having to leave it. The part-time online program accepts applications between August 1st and 31st. More at humboldt.edu/social work. Support by BNSF Railway. Proud partners of the American Indian Science and Education Society's National Conference, September 21st to 23rd. Helping prepare the next generation of STEM leaders. More at bnsf.com/tribal relations.
Native Voice One. The Native American Radio Service.
Ukrainian politician Mikhail Saakashvili was stripped of his citizenship when he left the country during a recent trip abroad. Saakashvili was once the president of the small nation of Georgia. He is currently in the opposition group to the current Ukrainian president, Petro Poroshenko, and had planned to lead protests against his government this fall. He states that, quote, as soon as those in power realize that the opposition is unifying in order to come out into the streets this fall and put an end to their oligarchic pact, their fear overcame their reason, end quote. Saakashvili had his Georgian citizenship revoked when he accepted an appointment from President Poroshenko as governor of the Odessa region. He is now stateless and claims that they are attempting to force him to flee to the United States, which he will refuse to do so. Saakashvili is a pro-European reformist and resigned from his post last year in order to start the opposition party to the current government that he feels is led by corruption and broken promises of Western reform.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Zion Bro, Dagan McSwain, Ray Bodwell, and Grace Ann Smith. The producer is Sam Bowman. Our engineer is Ben Sherigy. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Zelos Marchant. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KBOO News. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Tom.
And I'm Grace Ann Smith. Coming up tomorrow on KBOO. At 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, on Positively Revolting, Annie and Lynn take your calls. And at 9, One Land, Many Voices looks at the conditions in Gaza after the UN Coordinator for Human Aid said the area is unlivable and doesn't have the resources for human survival. At 10, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. At 11, Pacific Underground presents interviews, documentaries, performances, and real-time coverage of issues affecting the Asian and Pacific Islander communities of the Northwest. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you're not a current member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate.
On KBOO Evening News In-Depth today, we have a story from Cannabis Radio News. Cast light on the current momentum of the movement to legalize cannabis. The Washoe County Board of Commissioners is made up of four Republicans and one Democrat, Kitty Young. Young has been on the board since 2007 and is known for her environmental awareness, attention to issues of economic justice, and more than any other Washoe County commissioner, her understanding of medical and adult use cannabis regulation. In this interview, Brian Behuth chats with Commissioner Young about her efforts to implement medical and now adult use cannabis in Washoe County, Nevada.
Well, I think just being a student of history, prohibition has never worked for anything in America. Criminalizing substances in which many people are using as their own self-medication is so wrong-headed and such a waste of tax dollars and people's lives. And I really believe that all substances, I'm very libertarian when it comes to this, I think that they should be regulated and decriminalized and people helped out of the need to inject heroin and to make sure that they don't needlessly OD or create lots of crime to get their medication. So I think it would be, you know, a very long time ago, but to marijuana specifically, this is so full circle for me. As an undergrad, I worked with Dr. Senji Hu to do an experiment that NASA paid for, and we used federally grown marijuana and I can't remember, it was this drum that had lines on it. There's a technical name for it. And we took students through it because NASA has a big problem with nausea and vertigo. Mm-hmm. And what we were trying to discover for NASA is whether or not marijuana, and it was smoked at that time, would alleviate their nausea and vertigo, and it turns out it did. The trouble is they can't use it because your depth perception is altered when you are under the influence of the psychoactive ingredients.
Right.
So I just think it's so interesting then to move to Reno and get into politics, and you know, then I become the medical marijuana liaison to the Board of Commissioners, because my other commissioners, remember, they're all for Republican, and we run partisan. Mm-hmm. So while they were excited about, you know, potentially another revenue source and decriminalization, they didn't really want to be front and center. So you can see how it's evolved to come back around, and I'm proud of it. And I really believe that marijuana is far less damaging to society and to health than alcohol or tobacco products. So I, as a public policy matter, it's one of my least concerns, frankly. But what concerns me the most are the mandatory minimums and people, nonviolent people going to prison for marijuana possession and sale.
It sounds like then you're talking about a public health issue almost.
It surely, absolutely it is. It's, you know, for whatever reason, people imbibe, everybody imbibes. Something, you know, shopping mm-hmm. addiction, sex addiction, whatever, internet addiction. And everybody's an addict because everybody's troubled, right? Everybody had a traumatic experience at least once in their childhood or adulthood, no matter how perfect your parents were or your situations. And I think we'd do better to publicly fund mental health in the treatment of that than chasing after petty criminals.
I asked Commissioner Jung about the dialogue she's had with other commissioners about marijuana.
We run all gamuts of age. I think the oldest is a 70-year-old and the youngest is a 38-year-old. So, you know, a lot of people had that same manufactured mass hysteria in their mind that, you know, it's going to cause more problems. It's going to be, you know, oh my gosh, it's two blocks from a school. Well, so is Raley's Pharmacy, which is far more dangerous, and no armed guards 24/7. I mean, if you really wanted to get a hold of some good drugs, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
good either psychotropically or even what they're worth on the street.
Absolutely.
I would be worried about Raley's down the street with the pharmacy. You know, so some of my commissioners needed to be educated. They were ignorant, but not in the sense of a negative term. But mm-hmm. they just didn't understand. It was voodoo to them almost.
Sure.
But now, I mean, it's funny because, you know, when this first was all start happening, I think a lot of us were giggling and telling, like, making jokes to just get okay with it. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm, sure.
And I would definitely say now they're educated. Now, some of them will fight for their constituents to not have a dispensary in their area, but we overruled them. And I have the votes for that because everybody should share the wealth. And I do mean wealth. And that is... You know, when it turns out, again, I'm the Democrat and also the champion for first medical marijuana and now for full rec, but every time the neighborhoods would generate this mass hysteria, and it was manufactured, they would capitulate to them and move them, but then they'd move them to my district. So I said, I don't have a problem with it. My district, nobody complained at all. I don't have a problem with it. They don't have a problem with it. But here's the deal. I want to build a wall that around those monies and funds, the property tax, the sales tax, and then any excise tax, and that's staying in my community, my district. We're not throwing that in the general fund. Well, now I would challenge you to go to Sun Valley Boulevard, where there are two MMEs on opposite sides of Sun Valley Boulevard. I would argue they have greatly improved the safety, the attractiveness, the lighting, the sidewalks, and so tongue in cheek, I want to share the wealth because, you know, they need all of these other communities, Spanish Springs, Incline Village, also need more money for infrastructure and improvements that government cannot provide at this time.
As municipalities decide on how much to charge marijuana businesses for licenses to operate and sales taxes and other possible levies, I asked Commissioner Jung if there is a cognizance among county lawmakers that marijuana taxes are not a bottomless well.
Well, we know there's a sweet spot, right? Colorado definitely demonstrated that for us, because if you overtax it to a point that it's cheaper to get it from the cartel... Yes, so we have to be careful. You know, a lot of people are salivating to be making all this money, and we have to be really careful where we go with that, because if we make it so expensive that only the elite get it, we're going back to the streets. And while I would argue there is, as there is a sweet spot, the one thing that is really interesting about being able to buy it from a licensed distributor is that it's completely vetted for how much of a substance it has in it. It doesn't have Miracle-Gro in it, you know, like back in the day. It doesn't have mold. It doesn't have bugs, you know, all of those things. So some people always will pay a little bit more for that, but we want to make sure that it's also accessible.
Commissioner Jung said she will be circumspect when taxing marijuana businesses.
Well, I mean, I think it's up to us, anything that we want to charge.
Right.
Because Reno just threw another $70,000 to the MMEs to become rec,
right,
that they'd have to pay a year. Nobody's complaining, so maybe it's the right number, but we want to do a little bit more of a deliberative approach. Mm. We are ready to flip the switch on July 1st, and I'm committed to that.
I asked Commissioner Jung if she and the Washoe County Commission have communicated with the city of Reno on the regulation of marijuana businesses.
We haven't really worked at all together about it, to be frank. Mm. The way the law was set up, they were entitled to their amount of dispensaries, right? Medical marijuana dispensaries. Mm-hmm. And we kind of just let them go with it. There was a time that my commission was cautioning that we should wait and see what they do, or wait and see what Clark County does. And I was like, you know, that we're the leaders. We don't need to wait for anything. I mean, they can do what they want when they want. They are, you know, duly elected and they have their own jurisdictions. But we were the very first county or municipality, period, in the state that changed all of our development code legal code to allow the existence of MMEs before the state even told us what the requirements were going to be, because we wanted to be fast and models for it.
How consumers react to the opening of Nevada's medical marijuana dispensaries to the general adult public is a matter of conjecture, but Commissioner Jung said the pair of dispensaries in her district are ready and that the rollout of legal adult use cannabis in her district will be quiet.
You know, I'm not sure. We'll have to wait and see how it plays out, right? But I'm sure that the people that are ready to pull the trigger on July 1st have some distinctions on how they're going to handle it. I still think it's going to be quiet. I mean, if you've been in, I'm sure you've been into it. Quiet. It's clean. It's almost like a doctor's office, it feels like, a little bit. So I'm sure it's not going to be rambunctious and ridiculous for the time being.
I asked Commissioner Jung to look forward 5 or 10 years and describe the place of marijuana in Northern Nevada.
It'll be nothing. It'll be at every liquor store, every 7-Eleven. It will be grown-ups doing grown-up things and being responsible for themselves when they choose to alter their state of consciousness, which, by the way, since the history of humanity, at least in as much as we can read from petroglyphs, hieroglyphs, and then really writing, modern writing, human beings are compelled to alter their consciousness. There's even argument there's a gene in you for that, you know, like the God gene, but that human beings want to do it. When you watch little kids spinning around in a circle to get dizzy, that's an altering of consciousness.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Or one of my favorite things is, you know, some people don't like brain freeze. I love it. Ooh. Oh, I love it. I think it feels good. So, but that's an altered state, right?
Yeah, true.
So I think that the more that we become educated and more, a little bit more humanitarian rather than militant, you will see more progressive laws, behaviors, and democracy than in the past. I mean, that's just evolution.
What about the economic impact of legal cannabis?
Well, it has a tremendous economic impact. And we're not just talking about taxes and fees. Mm-hmm. You know, there's such a down chain for that. You know, people that supply the pesticides or herbicides for the grow. The people that supply the containers to put the product in. I mean, it's so large that it's difficult to put your arms around it. But I think that that is a part that we're missing out. And most importantly, when you go to the dispensaries, what I think is really interesting, these are young people, mm-hmm. right?
Mm-hmm.
Darling, cute, tatted up, alternative, millennials. And, you know, what a time to get in. And they too will be moving on to consult. And if they started from the ground, you know, floor,
yeah,
helping people work it out. I mean, I just, if you also think about the potential for people that are in this business that took the chance, right, and then employ, you know, over 40 people. Reef has over 40 employees, mm-hmm, full time. With benefits,
mm-hmm,
so it's such a different industry in that too, because most people that get into that, I can't say all, there's always sharks, right? And there's, sure, always people looking to make their fast buck, but in general, people that would take that risk have a different philosophy about life and how you treat your staff and employees.
The ultra-secure facility requirements and licensing fees for opening a medical or adult-use marijuana business in Nevada are considerable. So I asked Commissioner Jung if she believes there will be a place for mom-and-pop or boutique marijuana businesses in the state.
No. And you know why? Because it's regulated. And I really see it either being taken over by Big Pharma or the liquor industry. That's who's going to distribute it and take care of it. You know, maybe not in my lifetime there will be there will be artisan marijuana shops, right?
Sure, right? This is what I'm thinking, right? Do you see some, you know, like that, I guess, maybe so?
Yeah, but not for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's better to be a little bit more cautious, too. Again, we're building the trust and the culture of people that are not enculturated for this. You know, my parents are 81 years old, and it at first kind of scared them. You know, that I'm so loud about it, and, you know, you're never going to get another office. People are going to think you're the doper, you know, all this stuff. So, but even now they're like, they think it's, they're not interested in it,
mm-hmm,
yet. But
it should be.
But one day they will, you know, they have arthritis. And I'm not talking about to get high, because it's also so important for epilepsy, arthritis, PTSD, getting off opioids. I mean, there is a lot of data to support that, not necessarily the high, if that's not what you're looking at. Liquor doesn't have that same thing, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
They don't. The doctor doesn't say, take two shots of whiskey and call me in the morning. But a doctor could give you CBD oil. And like the dispensary down in Carson City, 90% of their clientele are veterans.
Mm-hmm.
So, and a lot of it's PTSD, but a lot of it is wound treatment or repair or missing of limbs, and that weird feeling that you get when you miss a limb.
Mm.
And they've found a lot of comfort in that, and not the psychoactive.
Commissioner Kitty Jung, thank you so much for taking time to chat with me.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 5:56. Coming up next, Rose City Native Radio.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Playing Monopoly with God and Other True Stories on August 4th, 7 p.m. at the Old Church in Portland. Playing Monopoly with God and Other True Stories will be performed by Melissa Bangs, who studied with the Upright Citizens Brigade. This is her one-woman comedy show about postpartum psychosis and healing through shared moments, laughter, and tears. Again, that's Playing Monopoly with God and Other True Stories on August 4th, 7 p.m. at the Old Church, 1422 Southwest 11th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good people, stay tuned every second and fourth Thursday at 8 p.m. for Guess Who's Coming to Radio, a show with music and discussion, addressing socio-political issues relevant to African peoples in this nation. We encourage you to call in with some positive, proactive solutions to what we are facing today. Guess Who's Coming to Radio, every second and fourth Thursday at 8 p.m. on KBOO, your community radio.
You are listening to a digital indigenous radio show. All across Turtle Island, turn up your radios and decolonize. This is Rose City Native Radio.
Can you tell us an Indian first, then?
Skagdosh, Portland, how's it going? It is Thursday evening, time for your Indigenous Power Double Hour. That's right, it's Rose City Native Radio at 6, and then after this is the Indigenous Power Hour mix with DJ Yellow Horse, who is also joining us in the studio today. We have music, comedy, poetry, super Indian, and much, much more for you today. Starting off this glorious summer eve is Medicine for the People, Vultures of Culture, here on Rose City Native Radio.
The same ones that he massacred.